Media reports made it difficult to be optimistic, even within the White House.
There was a baffling disparity between reports from MACV, that was our headquarters in Vietnam, and the stories that dominated the papers and the evening television screens. On several mornings, I arrived at the White House filled with shock and foreboding over what I had seen the night before, and I went to Walt Rostow's office to read the cables from Saigon. They were invariably optimistic, full of stratospheric enemy body counts, inspiring stories of South Vietnamese resistance, and so forth.
Harry probably didn't see television as he thinks now that he saw it. At the time, Harry was quite concerned about us being in Vietnam. It is obvious that Tet speeded up the American determination to move on out of Vietnam, and certainly had a great impact on public opinion in that direction and on government. But for people looking at it from the military standpoint, it was not disastrous. It wasn't a defeat at all. From the standpoint of those trying to handle the war, I think some of them were actually amazed and delighted that the thing held together so well, and that the losses inflicted on the Viet Cong and the recovery of Hue and other places rather quickly showed that Tet had been a failure. Unfortunately, most people in the country, especially because of the impact of television and the general coverage, was that it was a terrible defeat for us. It was all in the eye of the beholder.
What of Lyndon Johnson? How was he tuning into television's Vietnam? We know that he was a devoted viewer of television news. Peter Bastrop believes that the president was shaken by what he saw. What of Lyndon Johnson? How was he tuning into television's Vietnam? We know that he was a devoted viewer of television news. Peter Bastrop believes that the president was shaken by what he saw. Sometime during late March, Lyndon Johnson reached a major decision.
I was a strong advocate of Johnson not running again, and I thought the country was so divided that he was not doing himself or the country any favors by running for re-election. And even if he were elected, it would be increasingly difficult to govern the country, and the people were ready for a change, some change in direction.
Had Lyndon Johnson been a victim of Tet, or, like many others, did he use Tet as an excuse to act? Poll data indicated the president's need to take some dramatic step. In March 1968, a strong majority of those questioned, 52%, disapproved of the way Johnson was handling his job as president. Worse results involved the battlefield. By a narrow majority in December 1967, 46% felt America had done the right thing in sending troops to fight in Vietnam, while 45% thought it was a mistake. What a difference the Tet Offensive made. In March 1968, the largest percentage, 49%, thought it had been a mistake to send troops to Vietnam. The popular consensus had shifted from hawk to dove. On March 31st, 1968, the president provided the American people with his own media event. A few weeks after his speech, the president took a gentler look at his relations with the press. He poked fun at his own appearance, at the same time suggesting to his critics the importance of images in a time of political debate. It's time we drew some lessons from television's Vietnam. David Levine's famous cartoon highlights a lesson for government about the credibility gap. Government officials must not merchandise the truth in times of crisis. Johnson's Show Progress campaign in November 1967 made the 1968 Tet Offensive look much worse than it was. Leaders, tell the truth. Attempts to toy with public opinion may backfire. A second lesson. War aims must be clearly defined, even in a limited war. During World War II, 7 official Why We Fight films explained war aims to a worldwide audience. That clip was made in 1944. It helped communicate to Americans an understanding of war aims. In 1968, neither soldiers, government, media, though the average citizen clearly understood why America was fighting in Vietnam. If Americans are asked to fight and die for their country, they need to know why. In a crisis, the president must lead. At Tet, Johnson himself was overwhelmed by images of disaster, letting bad news numb him into inaction.
I think that at this very critical stage that I would much prefer it to be played low-key than give any false assurances. I can only say this, that based on the best military advice that I have, I feel confident that the men will give a good accounting of themselves. Now, Sarah, let's get...
Without presidential leadership, events or reports of events rule. The mass media during Tet reported a North Vietnamese military and political disaster as stunning victory, contributing importantly to a North Vietnamese psychological victory within the United States. Image and reality are not the same thing. Wait, let me do that again. It says image and reality are not the same things. Modern battles have images as their objectives as much as territory. One picture may need 1,000 explanations. A microcosm of disaster is not the same as disaster. Not every South Vietnamese official shot citizens. The visually literate will understand why microcosms can be misleading shortcuts to moral judgment. Especially for TV, drama can win out over information. In an election year, participants in a media horse race found... In an election year, participants in a media horse race find the rush to judgment irresistible. Politicians and pressure groups often use news as new clothes for old arguments without checking the accuracy of the latest information. It is irresponsible to exploit news... It is irresponsible to exploit news stories for political purpose. The impact of television news on political decision-making remains a mystery. Media scholars are uncertain. Reporters on the scene can be surprised by public response to their work. Network producers claim not to concern themselves with impact. As a practicing politician, Lyndon Johnson was stymied. When experts are unsure, it is not surprising that the man in the street is perplexed about the influence of visual news.
All I know is that I saw that picture and I decided that the war was not worth the candle. It just wasn't worth it.
Although no one knows precisely how news influences us, the press, especially television news, has become a political force in American life equal in power to the governing institutions created by our founding fathers. Unfortunately, we have no Federalist Papers to help us understand the virtues and the potential for excesses of this new institution. Unfortunately, we have no Federalist Papers to help us understand the virtues and the potential for excesses of this new electronic institution. David Halberstam, author of a recent study of the press, the powers that be. Let me do this one more time.
You can just start with David Halberstam.
David Halberstam, author of a recent study of the press, The Powers That Be, addressed himself to this change in the American system at a recent seminar of the Modern Media Institute. During the first week of April 1968, the 6,000 Marines at Khe Sanh went on the offensive. Weather, logistics, and the availability of new troops combined to set Operation Pegasus in motion.
This is Pegasus. And we moved over to that hill probably 3rd, 4th, somewhere around there. And we didn't encounter any resistance going from our hill over there. And it was a heck of a climb up that hill. I remember that. Our whole purpose here was to assist in the clearing operation. And we cleared, what we did was operate west of that hill line to clear there. And I really think what had happened at that point is the NVA were pulling out there and they had left a rear guard. Bravo was fortunate enough to have resistance. We found things like this. Bangalore torpedoes made out of bamboo and filled with blocks of TNT, and here's a Russian helmet laying here, and cases upon cases of ammunition. And we found a lot of grave markers, too, where NVA had been killed. Little pieces of aluminum where they'd taken a nail or a bullet or something and tapped out the name and the date of death. And we didn't bother to dig up any of them. We weren't that concerned about it.
As Robert Kahaney, now a city attorney in San Diego, recalls, not every exit from Quezon was conducted with formality.
Battalion commander asked me to be the last person out, and I did so. Unfortunately, myself, my radar operator, our forward air controller, and his radar operator ended up not having a helicopter. One of the other helicopters that had already taken off came back for us, but he was so overloaded and the situation was so tense that he couldn't stop his helicopter to let us board. We had to go out there in the airstrip and run down the airstrip behind him and throw our gear in. We did. We ran down and forward air controller threw his radar operator in, I threw my radar operator in, then the forward air controller, whose name I can't recall, jumped in, and somebody gave the up sign to the helicopter pilot. Helicopter started to take off. It was a 46. We were jumping in the back. They grabbed my arms, pulled me up, the helicopter took off, and they pulled me into the aircraft. As they were doing so, my cartridge belt caught on the lip of the ramp. The troops just kept pulling, pulled my pants all the way down. So there, after almost a year in Quezon, I left, mooning the combat base.
After Pegasus and after the war, Quezon would become a memory. There were memories of those who were lost.
As you sit and think, you can just remember. Wonderful. All these old shingle roofs out here. You can just remember. As you sit and think, you can just remember. You can just remember names after names of people who are dead now that, for one thing or another, they as you sit and think, you can just remember. You can just remember names after names of people who are dead now that, for one thing or another, they wouldn't be. And his name was Brereton. And everybody called him John Wayne because he didn't like to wear a helmet. He wore a jungle hat instead. And the Delta Company commander and Brereton and the chaplain's assistant and another guy were in there, and a round landed right in there and killed all four of them. And old John Wayne would have lived if he'd had his helmet on. And, just things like that. Our operations officer, he was medevac because of. He had on a flak jacket that was one size too big for him, and a piece of shrapnel came in the armhole. Strange things like that.
Along with memories of personal loss, was a sense of pride that a contribution to Marine Corps history had been made.
I had read a lot of Marine Corps history, and I had read about Guadalcanal and Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Chosin Reservoir. And at that particular time, I thought, gosh, you know, to be a Marine is great. This almost sounds a little warped, but that's what I thought at that time, and I still think it's a great extent. And to have an opportunity to see the Marine Corps in combat is something else. But to have the opportunity to participate in a battle that is going to go down in Marine Corps history along with those other battles is something that not everyone gets an opportunity to participate in. And as that battle unfolded, I really did not know that that is what was happening to me. But I think a lot of the Marines had that feeling up there.
I'm very proud of the role I played. I'm extremely proud of the men that worked with me. Their spirit was just unbeatable. They stayed cheerful in the face of the most adverse conditions in the Vietnamese War. And I never had one reason to worry or look back over my shoulder, whether it was at Khe Sanh Combat Base or whether it was out in the triple canopy of the jungle. They were always there.
Because Khe Sanh was linked to the controversy surrounding the Tet Offensive, many Marines found it difficult to communicate with friends back home about their experiences, even when they felt great pride in what they had done.
Last Veterans Day, just following that, we had a weekend drill. And when I arrived there for the first time that Saturday morning, everybody was standing around talking, and all the Marines got together, and we were sure that somebody was going to comment on Veterans Day because, the military and Veterans Day and everything. And it just started going around, and when it first hit me, people were saying, hey, this is War Criminal Day for all the war criminals that were, goddamn Vietnam. It was funny at the time, and everybody, we started laughing, and these right now, we're talking about 30-year-old men. We're not talking about the 19-year-old guys that were there at the time. And, we'd laugh about it for about a minute or two, and then all of a sudden, it would come time where just like in Vietnam, these 19-year-old kids would laugh about something, and then they'd get back to the seriousness of war. We'd laugh about it, War Criminal Day, ha-ha. And then the first thing that was said by everybody is no shit, which sums it all up, as in no kidding. This is how they view it. This is how the world views it. This is how our country views it and everything else. Just, big deal. And it's, that just sums it all up.
This is Tet, 1968. Up until Tet, Saigon had been an isolated haven. Suddenly, the streets of the city were a battleground, and the Viet Cong attackers were not easily dislodged. Sappers blew a hole through the wall of the U.S. Embassy and entered the grounds, killing a number of American guards in the process and tarnishing a symbol of American presence. In the northern city of Hue, Viet Cong forces occupied the center of the city and held their position for over 30 days. Marines at an outpost called Khe Sanh were fighting from fixed positions. The surrounded Leathernecks were outnumbered 4-1 by North Vietnamese regulars. After Tet, American public opinion turned against further efforts to prop up a Saigon regime which seemed cruel, corrupt, and ineffective. The word stalemate and quagmire became current. After Tet, Lyndon Johnson withdrew from the presidential primary and halted the bombing of North Vietnam. Peace talks quickly followed. All historians agree that the news media, especially television, played an important role in this dramatic shift of public attitudes and governmental policies. On the 10th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, a conference was held on the campus of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. A variety of perspectives were represented. Retired General William Westmoreland spoke for the military. Douglas Pike and Gareth Porter provided insight into Viet Cong and North Vietnamese intentions. The role of media was discussed by correspondents Peter Braestrup and Charles Moore. While Robert Norshield, producer of the Huntley-Brinkley Report during Tet, provided unique information about electronic gatekeeping. Scholars Larry Lichty and George Bailey shared their research about the impact of Tet stories. Each participant contributed a different perspective, and even though Tet was 10 years past, consensus was difficult to find. Eric Pettigrew helped our film crew. On the last day of the conference, we asked him to summarize some of the concerns felt by undergraduates who attended. It has been said that the controversy over television coverage of the war is indistinguishable from the controversy over the war itself. As Eric has indicated, there are practical reasons why Americans need to know more about both the war and how it was reported. We have spent over 3 years in our search for insights. Print and television journalists have been consulted. Military leaders and government officials have shared their views. Frontline veterans have been asked to compare Tet experiences with media images. This film has two purposes. First, it will attempt to give you a feel for the trauma of Tet. Along with the sense of a flow of history, the film will attempt to comment on the problems of visual reporting in a time of crisis. As you go through these experiences and listen to different reflections, we ask that you ponder this question. A question as mysterious yet relevant today as during the Tet Offensive 1968. How do we know what we know through visual news? Eric Pettigrew cited the famous insight of George Santayana: those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. With this dictum in mind, the conclusion of our film will attempt to provide some constructive suggestions. We feel that both government and the media made serious errors during the Tet Offensive 1968. We hope that our findings will help our country to avoid future reruns of television's Vietnam.
The Tonkin Gulf Revolution, which was passed by the Congress, told the president to, this we'll have to refer to get the exact word, but the sense of it was to use that force that was necessary to protect the freedom of South Vietnam. Or maybe they even made it broader than that, Southeast Asia. There was really a failure to tell the people in words of one syllable that they could understand that this was a war involving the security interests or the interests of the United States. Self-determination, I don't think this means much to the average man. In simpler terms, and perhaps in more mundane terms, the American people understand things real well. The Tet Offensive of 1968 was a tremendous victory for the North Vietnamese in the United States. Actually, it was a very substantial military defeat for them. They really got themselves creamed. But the way it was played in the press here created in the minds of the American people the same effect that the outcome of the first Battle of Bull Run did.